We head to La Crosse on Wisconsin's scenic western border overlooking the Mississippi. In our next stop, meeting mayors from all over the state here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. La Crosse is home to more than 52,000 residents as of the latest census figures. Its population growing by about 1,300 people over the decade since the 2010 census. And it has the tri-state views with the Mississippi River Valley below. What speaks to you about La Crosse? What challenges have you encountered with housing or work living in the area? 800-642-1234. Mitch Reynolds has been the mayor of La Crosse since April. Mayor Reynolds, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, let's start with geography first. La Crosse being this unique city that shares a border with Minnesota, do you feel that the city has to compete with Minnesota for jobs or residents?
Well, not really. No. I think we're, I don't know how, if we look at La Crosse as kind of this regional center, then we certainly have people who live across the border who come into La Crosse to work. La Crosse is, it's an urban core of this lightly populated area in southwest Wisconsin. And so certainly there are people that come from La Crescent or from, which is in Minnesota, or a couple of other small villages or towns over there. But for the most part, folks are coming here to work.
That's what I found, too. Economists call it a contained economy when the vast majority of people who live in a county work there. And I looked up La Crosse, given your location. I was curious. The Economic Development Corporation data from 2019 showed it up there around 80-90% of the county residents work in the county. But what about the city? You know, people coming to the city to live, work, and spend. Is that something you grapple with?
People living in the city to do that?
Yes.
You know, I think the one of the key challenges that we have is having housing for for folks who want to live here. And that's a challenge that small or even large urban areas around the United States are having and have had for many years, actually. And we're struggling with that now. There's no question. And that's why it's super exciting that we are in a time when we have so many housing units that are in the stage of development planning or construction. And it's a tremendous growth right now. We're just at the beginning of it. So it's really exciting to see what that's going to mean for the city over the next 5 or 6 years. So I'm really thrilled about that. When we look at the 22,000 or so homes we have in the city of La Crosse, over the next, you know, probably 5 years, we're looking at 1,500 additional homes that we're adding to the city, you know, within the city borders. So that's about, you know, 6-7% increase, which is a really big increase for this city. In fact, I think what I understand, if I was getting the right information, somebody told me that this is the largest surge of housing development within the city of La Crosse since after World War II.
Wow, that's remarkable. Is it a mix of housing, housing at all different types of levels?
Yes.
What do you see there?
Absolutely. Yeah, we definitely have a focus on affordable housing, but we are also, we're looking for development of all housing because we have homes that could be affordable, but because we have such a shortage of available homes, it increases the demand on the tight supply that we have and therefore driving up the rental rates or the purchase prices that are within our community. So one of my strategies which I think is going to be very effective is just to basically the market strategy of increasing supply. And yeah, we'll more people will come and live here, but we'll also take the pressure off this rental market and this housing market in general so that more homes become affordable, even if we're not adding just a pile of affordable homes. Now, we do have a number of affordable home developments that are coming online, and we're really focused on those. But there's, you know, we're looking at trying to add just all homes, just a lot of homes. That's all I'm really focused on.
We're talking with Mitch Reynolds, mayor of La Crosse, in conversation with municipal leaders across our state as part of a series to get at the heart of local government issues. You can join in. Do you live in La Crosse or the area? What issues would you like your mayor to work on? What questions do you have about how the city operates. 800-642-1234. Let's look at the issue of homelessness. This is something, as mayor, you've been really pledging to work on. Where are you on this front?
Yeah, we have spent a significant amount of time and effort on developing strategies and actually doing some work to help those who are unsheltered in our community. And it's just an enormous number of people. It's so many more than we saw prior to the pandemic here in La Crosse. We had somebody who was telling me that we have maybe twice as many. So our latest pit count, I think, was just completed on the 26th, a point in time count. And I think we're looking at 160 folks who are unsheltered in this community. And that means the folks that we've had placed in an emergency winter shelter at a hotel on the north side of La Crosse.
Econo Lodge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Econo Lodge, right. That's folks that are at the Salvation Army in shelter, folks at the Catholic Charities Warming Center in shelter. Those are folks that are, there's no places for them, and they wind up kind of bedding down in our parking ramps. It's a big number, and so that's a big challenge. We do have we're working with the county for planning ahead for developing some bridge housing for our community. There seems to be a universal understanding among our private service providers that bridge housing is something that we're lacking here in our community, and that would help especially with those individuals facing extremely high barriers to housing and really finding a path forward for them. That's the thing that we're working on in the next couple of years. For the spring, people are going to leave the Econo Lodge, our winter emergency shelter, and they're going to need some housing. So we're putting together what we're calling temporary bridge housing. So it'll be bridge homes is what we're calling them, small homes. And we'll be providing case management there to get folks into permanent housing, but at least having them have a stable level of housing in between now and then.
You've also been working with La Crosse County. You had this meeting in December coming together to potentially buy a downtown building as a long-term way to address homelessness. What is the status of that?
Right. Well, that fell through. That didn't go well. So we found it was a building and a large lot. And that was really the part that really was the most intriguing for us, because when we put up a bridge housing, it's going to be a congregate style housing with facilities for delivery of services. And so we looked at this building. It's basically right across the street from City Hall, and made an offer on it. And well, somebody else thought that that was not a good place for that, so came in and bought it before we could. But that's okay. We've got a different path forward, and we're looking for we're developing other strategies. So that did not work out, though.
The city also recently hired a homeless services coordinator. Is that right?
Right.
How is that going?
Good so far. This is the first time we've never had this position, and so. Mm-hmm. There is a really steep learning curve for someone filling that position. This is someone that we wanted. What I was looking for was someone who would be able to take all of our resources in our community, because we have a lot of resources to draw from, and coordinate those. Be basically our program manager for homelessness in the city of La Crosse. And so far, it's a lot of building relationships at this point, and understanding what all the resources are and how we can best utilize those, and developing strategies. But I like the progress we're making so far. I think it was the right move, and I believe we're going to see some really good impacts from this in the years coming forward.
La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds explaining the issues he takes on in his community on the western border. Are you a UW La Crosse grad? Where did that take you? Do you appreciate the La Crosse music scene or the upcoming La Crosse Winter Roots Festival? What challenges does the city face? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mayor Mitch Reynolds here on the Ideas Network. We're meeting up with mayors from all over Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today it is La Crosse, home to Granddad Bluff, with an expansive view of the city and the Mississippi River. What questions do you have about the environment, specifically how it's tackling PFAS contamination and well testing? What should cities do to address these environmental issues? 800-642-1234. La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. John is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi.
How about your city?
Sure. So I live in La Crosse, and I appreciate the discussion about affordable housing that Mayor Reynolds is discussing. Just wanted to get his opinion on how the relatively high property tax rate in La Crosse actually plays into that conversation.
John, thank you. Mayor Reynolds.
Yeah, thanks for that. And we do have I agree with John, a relatively high property tax rate. One of the reasons that is the case is that we have our housing stock is overall is somewhat dilapidated. And so the values of our housing is, or the value of our housing individually is not great. I think our median house value is something like $148,000 or something like that. And so what we have is the burden for services for this community is on the back of folks who live in housing in homes that don't have a terribly high value. And so the levy rate tends to be higher because the amount of property taxes that come from those homes is less. So it is, that's a challenge. But one of the things that was identified as a solution for that many years ago through a comprehensive study of housing within our city and our larger community is to simply to develop more new homes, which is something that, again, that I talked about.
Is underway.
And that's underway. For so long, we really focused on commercial property, and we wound up with a overabundance of commercial property and not enough new homes. And by developing those new homes, we increase our property tax base overall and should therefore decrease the levy and thus creating some level of property tax relief.
John, thanks for the question. Thanks for calling in. Let's move on to the environment. The city has had to shut down 2 of its wells that were contaminated with PFAS, forever chemicals, from firefighting foam used at the airport. What is the city considering doing to remedy this issue?
That's great. I just actually had a meeting. We do a monthly meeting with stakeholders on this issue with French Island. So we meet with the town of Campbell leaders and with members from the La Crosse County Board and the DNR and DHS and USGS. And there's probably others, but I can't remember who they are right now. So we meet every month to discuss strategies and moving forward. And obviously we were one of the first that started down this road, but a number of other communities around the state of Wisconsin and of course around the nation are tackling this as well. But what we're looking at right now is this, you know, it sounds relatively simple, but it's going to take some work, is simply supplying water through a municipal water supply to town of Campbell residents who don't have a municipal water supply at this point, not comprehensive anyway. So that's what we're going to be negotiating over in the immediate future with the town of Campbell. Those negotiations have begun. Not sure what that's going to look like, but that's going to be what we're going to do with that. In terms of remediation at our wells, that's something that's on a conversation that's ongoing. One of the things that we're relying on is, you know, this is an expensive process.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're anticipating that there'll be funding that we'll be able to access through the infrastructure bill that was passed recently and be able to really find ways to be able to bring those our wells back online. And also, make sure that we're protecting the rest of our water supply. Like you said, the PFAS chemicals are—they're forever chemicals. They're everywhere. They're in the Mississippi River. They're in our landfills. They're simply everywhere. And so we want to make sure that we're protecting all of our water supply. And that's going to be something that we're going to be strategizing with, hopefully, the use of these infrastructure dollars. We're also looking at that with our development or the upgrades to our wastewater treatment plant. We're looking at ways to keep PFAS out of effluent from that wastewater treatment plant, which is, you know, something that a wonderful way that we're looking forward, because these aren't even chemicals that are, there's not a, the DNR doesn't require a permit for those. And so we're looking at ahead at when we will have to remove these from our effluents. So that's something that we're working on right now. That's a major upgrade to our wastewater treatment plant. It's actually my favorite project in La Crosse. Because not only because it's forward thinking in terms of sustainability and resiliency, but also because it's going to be completely self-contained. It's going to power itself from the waste that's digested there, which means it'll come completely off the grid and also create enough power to supply electricity to our municipal buildings that are nearby and also recharge our electric buses
Wow.
that are coming online next month. So it's probably the coolest public works program that I'll be involved in here, but
and
I really like that.
Just one here, quick follow-up on, sure. on PFAS. You know, that's really interesting that you have this regular group meeting with a diverse group of folks coming from different agencies and locales, but what input are you giving right now to the DNR that is looking at regulations? But I'm just wondering, what are your talks like with the DNR as they look to figure out what to do next about PFAS regulation?
Well, I think that they're taking something from the conversations that we've started here, because again, we were sort of at the tip of the spear on this one here in La Crosse, and they're utilizing those types of conversations to get input from other communities. What they're doing with that, I'm not entirely sure. We are doing, you know, we've had to, as we were determined to be the responsible party for the contamination from our airport. Mm. And so we've done a number of two different site investigations there. The last one was just completed a couple of weeks ago and is on the DNR website right now. But that is, I honestly don't know what their process is for digesting that information and coming up with a path forward.
Mm-hmm.
We're supplying, what we're paying for is the site investigation, the analysis, the data analysis, all the testing, all of that, developing all the maps that show the groundwater flow.
So you have the good data, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let me just quick reintroduce you, Mitch Reynolds, Mayor of La Crosse, who's we discuss pressing issues with city leaders all over Wisconsin. Let's bring in Joe now in La Crosse. Hi, Joe. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mitch. I just had a question, I guess, on the school district of La Crosse and how involved you are with, like, the school board and decisions that are being made around the decision to, it looks like the school district of La Crosse is looking to consolidate maybe some schools and close down some older schools. And how involved are you in that decision, and what are your thoughts on it, I guess?
Joe, thank you. Mayor.
Well, thanks for the call, Joe. I'm not involved in the school district decision-making, obviously a separate government entity. I've had conversations with the superintendent about the potential impacts of consolidating schools, but how the school district moves forward is entirely up to the school district. And I can weigh in, but I don't get a vote unless it goes to referendum. And then by living in the school district, I certainly do. But at this point, it's an ongoing conversation that I have with the school district, that my planning department has with the school district. There's differences of opinion about how consolidation could impact our city. And
is that due to declining enrollment?
Yeah, what they're looking at, and you know, you can have a conversation with the school district to get a better understanding of what their processes are. But they're looking at declining enrollment and the maintenance of older buildings and all the costs that are inherent there, which is very important. I place a really strong value on neighborhood schools, the ability to walk to school, to bike to school. And at some point, once we get to a level of consolidation that prohibits that I believe we lose something here in our city, but we'll see how that works out. Again, I'm not part of that decision-making process.
Joe, thanks for the call. I want to land here in our just moments left. You have a Human Rights Commission, and I'm just wondering, yep. It meets regularly. What are its powers and duties?
It's an oversight board, and they do some advisory. They also evaluate housing complaints. The Human Rights Commission has been around for many years, and they're... they're active. I think that we could utilize the Human Rights Commission better, frankly, and that's something that we're working on. Part of what we put together a racial equity team in the city of La Crosse, so let's see, at the end of 2020, and we've expanded that racial equity team, and they have kind of a mutual advisory capacity with the Human Rights Commission, so we'll be working to expand how that commission evaluates certain equity complaints within the city of La Crosse, and that's a process that's in the works.
Well, Mayor Reynolds, thank you for joining us.
I really appreciate it, Kate. Thanks so much.
Mitch Reynolds, mayor of La Crosse, elected last April. Ahead this hour, we explore legislation that would end life sentences for juveniles. What do you think about sentencing teens to life in prison? Should Wisconsin law change? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary-Kate McCoy brings us a story about a conservationist helping farmers transition to managed grazing.
When it comes to successful conservation, working well with people can be more important than the science. One conservationist in southern Wisconsin is working to help farmers make the transition to managed grazing, a more environmentally and often financially stable farming practice. This story comes to you from the Grassland 2.0 Project podcast. Here's host Jacob Grace.
Serge Koenig has served Sauk County, Wisconsin for nearly 30 years as a county conservationist. He's seen numerous changes throughout his career, including in his own thinking about conservation. In the past year, Serge has helped transition hundreds of Sauk County acres to managed rotational grazing, a farming practice that is more economically stable for farmers and is often described as the gold standard for soil and water conservation. But Serge's journey to conservation began on the other side of the world during his childhood in Madagascar.
Growing up in Madagascar, we spent time in the woods and in the field all the time. We basically lived outside. And when I came to the U.S., it was a natural fit for me to go dive into something that I felt a strong connection to. This was the first job out of college that I got, and I've stayed here. It's been just such a good fit for me. Early on in my career, I was somewhat interested in rotational grazing, but we had a big toolbox that we picked from, and it was just a small tool. These practices were making some difference, but they weren't making the transformative differences that we needed to make.
As Serge spent more time on Wisconsin farms, he became impressed with how well managed grazing worked not just as a conservation practice, but as a profitable business for farmers.
When you look at all the soil health principles, well, managed grazing checks all of them and then some. And so it just made sense to go right to that. When I run the numbers with producers, it's awfully viable. You know, and you don't have to gross this much when your expenses are this low. And so at the end of the day, it's about what did you get to keep? And so that's a mindset that we're hoping to change. I know when we first started having pasture walks here, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we'd get 10 people maybe. And lately we've been getting close to 50 people.
Serge believes that the growing interest in managed grazing is not just due to its conservation benefits, but because many Wisconsin farms are actively seeking alternatives after dealing with years of economic hardship.
That's all part of the picture. It isn't just conservation. It's the people on the landscape that really drive the system. The job isn't really about conservation. It's really about working through the people stuff. It just always is. No matter how you slice it, it's always working through the people stuff. And when we approach it that way, just things work better. We don't talk about water quality. We just talk about quality of life, goals, grazing as an alternative, but like what you want, and talk about the finances, and all this other stuff just comes along for the ride. If we don't get that right, it doesn't matter how logical it seems on paper or even on the spreadsheet. It doesn't matter. That's why it has to be coupled with like life stuff. It has to be, and we have to be comfortable talking about that. And yep, you're going to get yelled at a few times. Yep, it's not going to be pleasant. And I've had all those things. But like, again, if you're driven in here, if that drive is there and you know your why, that's what we want to help our producers figure out. Why are you doing this? You better know yours, because, you know, it's not always smooth for you either. But like, if you know your why, it's so much easier to help others figure out what their why is.
This story was brought to you by the Grassland 2.0 Project, which seeks to transform Midwest agriculture through the use of grassland farming systems. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to advocates pushing to end the practice of giving life sentences to juveniles in Wisconsin. Following changes in more than two dozen states over the past decade, a bipartisan bill with about 30 signatures would prevent a court from sentencing a youthful offender to life without the possibility of parole. What factors should courts consider when sentencing young offenders? 800-642-1234. And please be mindful that this conversation could be disturbing, talking about violent acts. Domine Meek was imprisoned nearly 28 years for a murder he committed when he was 15. Released in September 2020, will be on extended supervision for the rest of his life. And Domine is a team leader for the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. Domine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Good morning. And Preston Shipp is here, senior policy counsel for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, working to ban life sentences without parole and other extreme sentences. Preston, welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me to join you.
Preston, you've been an advocate working in this space to end these life sentence laws on the books. Wisconsin, very much on your radar. How do you feel when you look at Wisconsin? How do you feel about juvenile justice as you see it in our state?
Well, I'm extremely excited to be working in Wisconsin. You know, that we have seen a very rapid national trend over the past decade away from life without parole for kids, which is basically condemning a kid, you know, to die in prison. And so we have seen 25 states already pass this kind of legislation. And so Wisconsin has this great opportunity with a bipartisan bill to say that in Wisconsin, kids should not be sentenced to die in prison.
I'm wondering if we could just take a moment here and you first share your story of nearly 13 years ago. You were an appellate prosecutor in Tennessee, and then you had this real eye-opening experience while teaching a class at a local prison. What happened?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking about that, because I went to law school to be a prosecutor here in Tennessee. I very much believed, you know, in the tough on crime rhetoric, you know, and you do the crime, you do the time, and cared a lot about public safety and the rights that victims have, you know, who have suffered harm. And so, you know, that was my career. I didn't see myself really ever doing anything different. But then the college that I attended started an inside out program where they offered college classes at a prison here in Nashville. And the guy who ran the program was my major professor. And so he invited me to come teach. He knew I was a prosecutor, invited me to come teach a pre-law class. And that was really the first experience that I had outside a courtroom with people who were incarcerated. And it just made all the difference in the world. You know, when you put your chairs in a circle and you start sharing stories and you start hearing about the context in which crimes are committed. And what I was confronted with, you know, when I got proximate, I was confronted with a group of people who were remarkable, who were good, who I was rooting for. I would have been happy to write letters of recommendation. They, even though they were serving, many of them were serving very lengthy sentences, even life without parole, they had invested heavily in rehabilitation and programming. They were just waiting for an opportunity to prove that to somebody. And that's what these bills are about, especially for children, is that, you know, we don't give up on kids because, you know, kids can commit, you know, violent crimes, but they don't forfeit their humanity. They're still kids.
Domine, you hearing the words remarkable and good, I'm wondering if you can share your story. You know, as a 15-year-old, you pleaded guilty to the crime of murder.
Yes. So I was 15 when I committed my crime. I killed an innocent bystander while attempting to kill another member of an opposing gang. Not that my victim was a member of the gang. He was, like I said, an innocent bystander. I went on the run for 2 weeks after doing that, turned myself in, went through the juvenile justice system, was ultimately weighed into adult court 4 months after I was arrested. Spent the next 5 months in the county, Milwaukee County Jail. And ultimately pled guilty to first-degree intentional homicide. 2 days after I pled guilty, I was sent, after 2 days after I received my sentence of life in prison, I was shipped off to Dodge Correctional Institution to begin serving my life sentence. It was on my 16th birthday. Mm-hmm. And I was housed with, you know, in the county jail as well as in prison. At the time, I was housed with some of the pretty big dudes. You know, it was a pretty scary experience, frightening experience, but.
At 16, did you realize what that life sentence really meant to you?
No. I had no idea, no concept of, I barely knew realized what it meant to turn 18 or 21, you know, let alone that I would be 43 at the oldest, at the youngest when I saw parole, or that I could actually die in prison. I had no concept of a future beyond maybe 5 years past the age I was 15 or 16 at the time. So no, I had no concept of that.
You also read a very much remorseful statement in court to that judge and to the family of the victim that gave you, I understand, the possibility of parole. Do you remember those words or writing those words or what that was like?
I remember some of it. I don't remember everything I said.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I said then, and I still do believe that I'm sorry, which is all I could tell my victim's family, mm-hmm. wasn't enough. I do remember taking accountability for my actions, which I still do. And I remember there was a poem, it was a lot in it. Mm-hmm. I do remember the remorse, which I felt then, and I still feel now. You know, I hurt a family, you know what I'm saying? I left a hole in a family that still hasn't healed, will never heal. You know, I recognize that the pain and suffering I caused them and caused others in my community. You know, there were other persons who were injured in my crime and who, or even if they wasn't, just the fear that I increased in my community and the lack of safety that I increased in my feeling of safety in my community, that's still going on. You know, I caused a lot of trauma, you know, and I still live with that. And I still regret that deeply to this day.
Preston, what do you hear in Domine's story?
You know, Domine, he's remarkable. I know Domine, and he's remarkable, but he's not unique. You know, so much of what he shares is very consistent with what other young people who have caused harm, what they experience. You know, when they reflect back as adults on those moments, you know, they talk about how they did not appreciate really the consequences of what they were doing, the potential for harm, the lack of impulse control, not being able to regulate their emotions. They almost universally share an experience of trauma, of suffering harm themselves, of being, you know, under peer pressure. Yet, you know, they have this profound potential as young people to move beyond those moments and mature the way that we all do. Mm-hmm. And so you give them some time and they all of a sudden they're in their mid-20s, they're in their late 20s, they're in their early 30s, and their brain has fully formed and they feel a profound sense of remorse. And they want to do whatever they can to try to atone, you know, for the harm that they have caused. They want to try to make things right. And so Domine and so many people in our incarcerated children's advocacy network, it's not just that they've gotten out and are moving on. You know, when they're released, when they get that second chance, they're finding ways to invest in their communities to try to make a difference. Yeah.
Preston Shipp, Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, Domine Meek with the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What do you see in juvenile justice reform? What does it mean for Wisconsin? We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's pick up the conversation about efforts for juvenile justice reform in Wisconsin. Advocates seeking to end the practice of giving life sentences to juveniles. Still time to talk about youth justice informed by your experiences in the criminal justice system. 800-642-1234. Domine Meek of the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice and Preston Shipp with the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. They're with us for about nine more minutes. Domine, back in the 90s, when you were sentenced, there was truth in sentencing laws that came along that increased prison sentences by requiring inmates to serve out at least 85% of their prison sentences without an early release. And that was targeting you, truth in sentencing, essentially eliminating parole for offenses. What do you remember about that? And what do you say to truth in sentencing?
I remember, thankfully, it came after I had already been incarcerated. But I met many guys who are affected by truth in sentencing, who's going to die in prison unless laws are changed and grace is shown. And these guys, I said before that, as a representative for the guys in prison, I don't think I do. I'm just not one of the best. There are guys in prison who could speak better than me, who could do this job, do what I do so much better, who can be out here contributing to society in ways so much greater than what I can do, than what I am. And they're going to die in prison. They were 14, 15, 16-year-old when they committed their crime, and they are not the same people they were when they went in because of truth in sentencing. And we, what Wisconsin told our children at that time is that we're worthless, that we're irredeemable. And that's sad that we, as a society, as a state, we threw away our kids, that we feared our kids that much. When the trauma that we suffered as juveniles, as kids, that informed our decision, not caused it, but definitely should be considered as mitigating factors, wasn't that we were considered super predators as children. You know, we were kids. We did violent and harmful things, and not diminishing the crime at all, but we were kids, and we don't have to be feared. We needed help. We needed medical treatment, and most of us didn't get none of that while we were incarcerated. Wasn't able to get any of it while we were incarcerated.
What I'm hearing you say too, Domine, you know, we weren't born this way. So many factors contributed in the upbringing, in the environment that you lived in.
Yes, many of us experience physical, mental, emotional, and sexual abuse as children. Many of us experience varying degrees of poverty. Some of us were literally raised in the streets and on the streets, raised in gangs and things like that. When it's no different than kids over in the Balkans during the wars over there that raised around violence and shooting, or raised in some parts of Africa as children, as child soldiers and things like that. We were that in America for some of us. You know, we lived every day hitting the floors when gunshots rang out, seeing our friends, sometimes our very family members, killed in front of us. You know, or being told, given guns and told to go kill somebody ourselves by those who are older than us, things like that. The gang culture in America that many of us grew up in is in many ways no different than that. And again, this doesn't excuse what we did, but the trauma that we experienced, I would hope that American citizens, Wisconsin citizens, that the empathy they feel for children in other cultures and other countries, they would feel for their own citizens, their own children here in Wisconsin, and do for us and give us the same treatment that they would like to see them children elsewhere receive, which we didn't receive when we were sentenced. We were called predators.
Domine Meek with us, team leader for the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. Preston Shipp is here, senior policy counsel for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. Preston, we heard from Lauren in Burlington, called in, couldn't stay, and Lauren's friend was brutally murdered by a 14-year-old. And the DA wants to let the girl go when she turns 18. Lauren is wondering if there are certain people who shouldn't return to society.
Well, you know, I hate to hear that story, and my heart goes out to Lauren, and, you know, this is hard work that we do, because, you know, folks are not going to get life without the possibility of parole or other extreme sentences unless, you know, there has been grievous harm done, and we want to hold space for that and mourn, you know, when lives are lost. We work with victims and survivors of youth violence every day. And it is, you know, you want there to be, you know, some measure of healing. You know, I think what this bill focuses on is the question of whether there should be opportunities mm-hmm. for young people who commit harm to demonstrate that they have been rehabilitated, that they do not pose any ongoing threat to public safety. It's not an automatic, you know, where after a certain period of time, everybody just gets to go home. You know, what this bill does that representatives Novak and Bowen and Spiros have introduced is it says that when you're dealing with somebody who is under 18, too young to vote, too young to sign a contract, too young to serve on a jury or get married, when you're dealing with a kid that after 20 years for a homicide crime, they get a second look, 15 years for a non-homicide crime. And there is no guarantee that that person, you know, is going to come home. They're going to have to demonstrate that is in the interest of justice, that they do not pose a threat, that they have been rehabilitated the way that Dominique and all these other folks that we work with have. I think that the tough on crime policies that you were talking about a minute ago, you know, they were born out of this myth that there is a certain class of children, overwhelmingly applied to Black children, who cannot change. And we know that that's a lie. We know that those policies were based on an untruth. But we were sort of led to believe that justice is a zero-sum game in which you can either care about the rights of victims or you can care about rehabilitation of people who cause harm. You can either care about public safety or you can care about second chances. And that is not how justice works. Mm. We can hold those values all together and work for something better for people who have suffered harm as well as for people who caused that harm.
Preston, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Domine, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Domine Meek, team leader for the Wisconsin Alliance for Youth Justice. Preston Shipp, senior policy for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. And you're listening to the Ideas Network.